Welcome to Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell, awakening the world to the power of God's Word. And now, here is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Normally we consider theological issues related to our faith, but today we dive into the historical and aesthetic side of the church. Our guest, Terry Ruskin, is a photographer, author, retired advertising executive, and most pertinent to our topic, Terry is an avid lover of history. We will survey the historic edifices that shimmer with beauty from coast to coast, from the historic missions in California to the monumental church markers in the quiet mountains of western North Carolina. Welcome, Terry.
Thank you.
Terry, give our listeners a sense of how you first developed such an interest in history.
Well, I'm not quite sure how it developed, but I know that I've been interested in history since I was a child. I might have been considered hyper-inquisitive, wanting to know what made everything tick, whether it was a rock or a mineral or a mushroom or a bird or an old building or an historic character. The subjects of history and geography were always my favorites throughout school, and I didn't really start delving deeply into historic research until I was in California and discovered the historic Franciscan missions, and then that led me to the Spanish conquest of the southwest United States, and it went from there.
Your love for church and culture really come together in your incredible volume on the missions of California, Mission Memoirs. What motivated you to write this volume?
Well, I didn't really set out to write a book. I was enchanted with the physical plants, and I met through my interest in the missions and the history of early California. I met a number of curators and docents, archaeologists, historians, researchers that became my good friends and colleagues. And I kept notes, as I tend to do, about things that intrigue me. And I made photographs and I did sketches. And a lot of folks that saw the material suggested that it could be a coffee table book, and so I took it from there. I really consider that project a gift, because at the time I was dealing with a lot of loss in my life. My two best friends had died in a plane crash, and within a couple of months of that occurrence, my father was diagnosed with cancer at an early age, and we lost him 5 months later. And then my dog died, and I was frankly beside myself, and I could not lose myself in my business, even though it was very demanding. And a friend of mine, a client who had become a friend, you see, in business I didn't have much time for a social life, so I combined the two on occasions, and she is still a very accomplished violinist avocationally, and played with the San Diego Symphony, and they were performing Handel's Messiah at Mission San Luis Rey in Oceanside, California, and she invited me to that concert and suggested that I visit the other missions as well, and I have to confess that I had not seen any of them up to that point. And so this woman essentially led me on the journey. She guided me into the journey, and I took it from there. And I did find it very cathartic and a way to deal with my depression, which was stemming from all of the loss. It was the first time in my life, I was in my 30s at the time, the first time in my life that I dealt with that much loss all at once. And so I consider it a gift from God that I discovered these places and that and I was able to deal with the grief through heavy research and maybe almost an obsession, but I think sometimes obsession leads to good things.
Wow. You've written other books. I think of Taste for Travel, released in 2003. I especially want you to focus for a moment on your book, Los Duendes, published in 2004. Does this somehow connect with your passion?
Absolutely. I discovered Blessed Fray Junipero Serra, the vertically challenged Mallorcan Franciscan friar who founded the California missions, and I wanted to explore him further, and so I went to his native land, which was Mallorca, one of the Balearic Islands off the coast of Spain, And, of course, you don't fly directly into Mallorca. You fly into Spain. And although I'd been all over Western Europe, I had somehow not visited Spain. And all it took was a visit to become absolutely enchanted with it. Furthermore, some folks out in California, a group known as Los Californianos, descendants of the original settlers of the Californias, had asked me to speak to them about my mission studies. They told me that I had the duende. And so I thought, well, what better place to discover the true meaning of that word? And if you look it up in a Spanish dictionary, you'll see that it means imp or ghost or what have you, but it means so much more. And I really wanted to define the word, and I was fascinated with the country. So I visited all of its autonomous regions, and I asked people wherever I went, a cafe, restaurants, museums, archivists, and so forth. I asked them, what is duende? And everyone had a different answer. So eventually I made my own conclusions. And so there's a thread of duende that runs through this entire book. And there's also a chapter on Blessed Junipero Serra and his native Mallorca.
Mm. Tell us more about Blessed Junipero Serra. I'm aware that there's a general sense by some historians that those who founded these early missions were oppressors. They stripped rights from the natives. Is that how you see it?
Certainly not in Serra's case. Surely there were military abuses, and when you study the subject, you find that the soldados, the soldiers, were taking a lot of liberties with the native women and even children. Serra fought this. In fact, he ended up separating the missions from the presidios. The presidios were the fortresses, and the missions, a lot of people think that a mission is a church, and a church is just a part of a mission. Essentially, they were young pueblos, or young cities, villages, towns, with workshops and residential quarters and agricultural pursuits and animal husbandry. They were young communities, and Serra fought to keep the military away from his potential converts and his converted ones. In fact, he even walked from the Monterey Bay to the city of Mexico to appeal to the viceroy for a bill of rights for the native Californian people to keep the military from abusing these people. I can't speak for all missionaries because I haven't studied all of them, but in Serra's case, I have read testimonials from descendants of his native charges who have marvelous things to say about the man. In fact, his disciples called him El Viejo, an affectionate term meaning the old one. He was seen as the old father. You know, a lot of these modern revisionist historians will say that, you know, if he called them my children, which a lot of, when I was growing up, even when I was a teenager, the priests in the diocese where I lived called everyone their children. I don't care how old they were part of the flock, they were children. But today in this politically correct world, we have to watch what we say. So we can't judge a man from that century by today's standards. I study him scientifically. I look at the proof. I look at the evidence. I look at the documents. I look at everything that's been written about him, his confreres, descendants of his converts, and I find no fault with the man. No one's perfect, of course. I'm sure that he had his transgressions, but he did not, to my knowledge, abuse any of the Indians. The man was not lacking for zealous faith, that's for sure. He wanted to found missions all the way up the coast of the west coast of the United States. If he had lived long enough, we'd have them all the way up through Alaska, I suppose. We have also studied him deeply in order to canonize the man, and that is a very elaborate procedure.
You know, you have been editor of Siempre Adelante, a newsletter, for a number of years, supporting the goal of seeing Blessed Serra become canonized by the Catholic Church as a saint. Terry, a lot of our listeners are not Catholic. Would you mind just explaining a little more how the process of canonization works? What will it take for Serra to receive this status?
How much time did you say we had?
maybe just hit a few points of it.
I will do my best to abridge this. The long, drawn-out procedure begins with the diocesan tribunal, in effect, the documentary phase. Typically, a person submits a possible candidate for sainthood to a local diocese, and the local bishop investigates the candidate's life and writings and gathers testimony for evidence of heroic value. The bishop then sends his findings to the Vatican. Adding to the complexity of this process, I might add that this the process of documentation and evaluation of the life and virtues of a holy man or woman usually cannot begin until 5 years after the candidate's death. Exceptions would be when a pope waives the 5-year period, in cases including Benedict XVI having waived all 5 years in the case of John Paul II, and John Paul II having waived the time frame for Mother Teresa. Next, we have a panel of Vatican theologians and the cardinals of the Congregation for Causes of Saints evaluating the candidate's life through the bishop's findings. If the panel approves, the sitting pope proclaims that the candidate is venerable, meaning the person is a model of Catholic virtues. The panel would then recommend a decree of heroic virtues to the Holy Father, whose judgment is final. Once the cause has begun, the individual would be considered a venerable servant of God. Now, in Junipero's case, his former student and his fellow missionary in America, in Alta California, Father Francisco Palau, nominated his teacher, his fellow missionary, for veneration. And this would have been shortly after Blessed Junipero's death in 1784. But it was a long time before the cause of canonization was really taken up. And then back to the steps, the next would be beatification. A posthumous miracle must occur concerning the candidate's intercession. The evidence is weighed in a court-like setting at the Vatican. Medical miracles must be proven to have occurred above and beyond all possible medical cures. And today that's quite difficult because we do have some incredible cures. A caveat would be martyrs who may be beatified without evidence of a miracle, with martyrdom recognized as a miracle of grace. Backing up a bit, the Congregation for the Causes of Saints establishes both scientific and theological commissions. Imagine a courtroom. Throughout the investigation, the general promoter of the faith, or devil's advocate, raises objections and doubts which must be resolved before the case resumes. A second proven posthumous miracle must be proven before the person is ultimately canonized. And I want to point out, however, that the Pope does not make a person a saint. Rather, he declares that the person is with God and is an example of following Christ and worthy of imitation by the faithful. Moreover, the Church does not choose saints. God chooses them. Now, for Blessed Sarah to become a saint, we need to have one more miracle proven. He is beatified, and there was a miracle proven. Father Eric O'Brien was the first person who really took up the cause after Francisco Palau had Sarah nominated for veneration. And this wasn't until 1941 when Father O'Brien had become first vice postulator for the cause of canonization of Blessed Sarah. Succeeded by Father Noel Moholy and then Father John Vaughan, the cause continues its course. Sarah was venerated on recommendation of Francisco Palau, as I mentioned, in the 1700s. The cause wasn't taken up until O'Brien in 1940s became very passionate about Sarah's life. A miraculous cure was proven in 1986, and John Paul II visited Carmel in 1987. Sarah was beatified in 1988 after the miracle was proven. And it's ongoing. A vice postulator, by the way, keeps records and prepares documentation. Essentially, he carries on from that original archdiocesan bishop who begins the process, collecting artifacts, investigating reported miracles and the associated medical records, and uses the media and modern technology to promote the cause for beatification and canonization of the candidate. With this Siempre Adelante newsletter, we are promoting this cause internationally. The more people you reach, the more people that are inspired by Sarah's work, the more people who would pray to him for miraculous intercession, the more miracle submissions you end up with. It's a numbers game. If we can prove one of those miracles, we will push him through to canonization. And, of course, it is my wish and prayer that I will see this in my lifetime. But at least I know that I've done my share in promoting his cause. Siempre Adelante, by the way, is part of Sarah's motto. He's used to say, Siempre Adelante, nunca atrás, which means always forward, never back.
Interesting. Well, thank you for helping us understand a little more of that process. And we thought some about the man. Let's think more now about the missions. In the Presidios in Southern California, Give us a little background. What is a presidio, and why were these missions established?
Well, we have to back way up before the Spanish decided to colonize California. The Russians and the British and others had eyes on that wonderful real estate, so to speak. And Spain had already claimed it as her own, but did nothing to colonize it. And of course, in order to claim territory, you have to colonize it with your own people. When the Russian fur trappers and other Russians were moving down the coast from the Bering Strait through Canada, Washington, Oregon, and California with their endeavor to trap sea otters, because that fur was considered very fashionable at the time, they also set up fortresses and establishments along the western coast. And King Carlos III of Spain saw this as a threat to his expanded empire. And so he sent an expedition from Mexico up through Baja California and then eventually into Alta California, which we now consider the Golden State. And this was both temporal and spiritual. Of course, Spain is a very Catholic country, and so the Spanish friars accompanied the military troops. And the thought was to colonize California with its own native people. And in order to do that, they had to be converted. In order to be good Spanish citizens, they had to be Catholics as well. And again, aside from all the political correctness of today, these people in the 1700s and early 1800s believed that was the thing to do. Serra was a very religious man, a man of deep faith and great zeal, and he wanted nothing more than to convert pagans to his religion. Presidios were fortresses, and they were set up to, of course, to fire against any opposing nations who might want to stake claim to Spain's territory. And originally, those presidios would have encapsulated a community, which included the mission church and all the workshops and so forth that I mentioned earlier. But when Serra discovered that this wasn't going to work, you see all these soldados, the military had not come with their women, and certain things happened that appalled Blessed Serra. It also got in the way of his religious work, and so they were separated. For instance, Mission San Diego, which was the first one founded in 1769, the mission was soon moved to another location, just actually up the valley from the Presidio, but it did keep a distance between the soldiers and the converts and potential converts. Serra wanted to establish missions all up and down the coast, and he succeeded in directly establishing 9 of them in his lifetime. There are a total of 21, and the rest of them were all established under his plan. Besides the missions and the presidios, there were also what they call asistencias or satellite missions, essentially an inland group of small missions which could serve the native populations in those areas. And there were ranchos and estancias, essentially the agricultural and livestock enterprises that had to support these missions. Quite a convoluted system, but all based on European agricultural ways, and the native charges were taught not only in spiritual matters, but also they were taught European methods of agricultural and animal husbandry.
Listeners, if you've just tuned in, we have with us as our guest this morning Terry Ruskin. And rather than take our normal tact on theology, that's a study about God and how it works itself out in the world, we're thinking more about history. He's a historian, and the aesthetics that flows through history in many of the beautiful edifices left behind. Terry, you're a photographer, and the work you've done in the book we're considering now, Mission Memoirs, a collection of photographs, sketches, and reflections of California's past. It's exquisite. The overlays of personal historic narratives you've put in your book have made it, I think, truly a classic. What were some of your favorite missions, and why?
It would really be difficult.
That's a tough one.
Pin down a favorite or even a few favorites. I'd have to say that Mission San Carlos Borromeo in Carmel, what we now call Carmel. Mm. It is a very Moorish-looking mission. It probably it looks like what a lot of the others would have looked like had secularization not occurred in the early 1800s. You see, these missions evolved. They started out as simple thatched huts daubed with some mud, and then as the the padres and their converts had time, they would make adobe bricks and eventually build more elaborate churches and outbuildings. And then if there was a local stone quarry, they would also build these places of stone. We see stonework at Mission Santa Barbara and at San Carlos in Carmel. San Carlos is a beautiful mission, beautiful setting. It's where Junipero Serra served as presidente, Father Presidente of all of the missions. It was his headquarters, although he visited the other missions and even made some return trips to Mexico in the interim periods. And he is also buried there. Because of my love for him and my admiration of him, it draws me. It appeals to me very much. But then there are simpler missions that have an aesthetic appeal to me as well. One particular place is actually an asistencia of Mission San Luis Rey. It's called San Antonio de Pala, and it's on the Pala Indian Reservation just outside of Oceanside in San Diego County. It has a lot of quaint charm to it, and when you mention aesthetics, that is what draws, I think, a lot of people to these churches. There's a lot of symbolism that I think enhances our faith. We look up, our eyes are drawn upward in these magnificent places. The vaulting provides for marvelous acoustics so that the music, which also appeals to a lot of us aesthetically, I think can help deepen our faith. The Indians were allowed to do their thing, so to speak. The padres saw that a lot of them were artistically inclined, and they would show them holy cards and icons, and they would have their native charges paint the missions themselves. The padres may suggest something to them, but then they would do their own thing. Bright colors, colors that a lot of us wouldn't dare put together, but somehow it works. Very appealing, quite beautiful, especially over the years as they take on a patination and the colors soften and blend. So actually, I would have to say if I had to pin it down to a favorite mission, I have at least 21.
Listeners, as we have been on the West Coast thinking about the markers left behind by the church through these missions and the beauty, I just want to say to you, you can't begin to just verbally pick up on all that's there. Go out and visit California and do a tour of the missions, or more simply, get a hold of Terry's book. You can find this, if you Google it, you can find it on Amazon, for example. I was surprised, Terry, for such an incredible volume. It's not really that expensive, and it's still available, so... Well, people may consider that.
When it was first issued, it was $50. It's a large, oversized coffee table book. It's hardcover, and it has onion skin overlays. And actually, that book would have cost about $100 or $125. I was turned down by the best publishers of coffee table books in the country because it was a regional topic, and they wanted to print zillions of them. Publishers are all about making money. I did this project for love. I didn't care if I made any money at all. And I went to a writer's conference at one point when I was trying to get this book published. It was suggested to me that I go after a grant to help defray the publishing cost so that it could be published as I envisioned it, massive, large volume with onion skins and so forth. And I noticed that Mervyn's California, which was a big department store chain with corporate headquarters in the Bay Area, had sponsored a man named Huell Hauser, a Tennessean, who gave tours of the missions that were broadcast on PBS television. And these were nice tours and whatnot, but I didn't think that a Tennessean was probably the best person to have given these tours. I thought maybe a native Californian, a descendant of one of the indigenous people, or perhaps a Franciscan, or at least a California historian. And I thought, my goodness, if they're sponsoring this program, putting money behind it, what would they think about a really sophisticated project? And so I appealed to them. I had an advertising agency at the time, and I had my artist dummy up a chapter for this book per my sketches and my art direction. And I sent it to corporate headquarters of Mervyn's California, FedEx, and the next day I had a call. They said, when can you come up with the rest of the dummy? They wanted to see the entire book. So I put a fire under my staff, working between deadlines, real work, flew up with the dummy, and they said, how much money do you want?
Wow.
Another miracle. When I told my publisher that I had no idea how much to ask for, but I asked for a significant amount, they said, why didn't you ask for more? Uh-huh. But essentially, that got the price point down to $50 per volume. And if you find gently used copies on Amazon.com, it's certainly even less than that.
Listeners, we'll be right back, and we're going to move after this break from the West Coast to the East Coast.
You are listening to Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. To discover more about Beyond Words and the other ministries of Scripture Awakening, visit us on the web at scriptureawakening.com. While there, you can learn about our amazingly successful Bible reading program, B90, or Bible in 90 Days. You can review the extensive catalog of our versatile Bible study series titled Be Next. You can also download free podcasts from all Beyond Words programs. Check out B90, Be Next, and Beyond at scriptureawakening.com. Here once again is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
Welcome back. We have with us as our guest Terry Ruskin, who is a historian and a photographer who has a real love for the story of people through history, but also of the church, not just here in America, but as we've seen in Europe and in America on both coasts. And Terry, as we focus here on the East Coast, what more naturally could we do than focus on our own region? I mean, there's so much history all up and down the seaboard, but right here in Henderson County, there's a lot that can be said, and especially by you. In 07, you wrote the book Hendersonville and Flat Rock, An Intimate Tour, and this year you came out with your Hidden History of Henderson County. So what inspired you to dive into history here in our local area?
Well, California was so far away, and of course I can still study that subject, and I still amass ephemera and material on California history. It's a hobby. I'm sure that I always will. Always looking on eBay for those unusual items, books and maps and documents and so forth. But now that I'm here, we have an incredible, for a small town like Hendersonville, we have our Henderson County Genealogical and Historical Society, which is a marvelous archive. We also have a heritage museum and a lot of interested folks here, a lot of people interested in their history and heritage. But our early settlers here weren't fastidious chroniclers like the Padres of California, and so it becomes a real challenge sometimes to get it all straight. And I love a challenge. I love sleuthing. When I first moved here, I naturally wanted to know everything that made it tick, and it was strongly suggested to me that I meet Louise Bailey, the late Louise Howe Bailey. And not only did I meet her, and not only did she teach me so much about the local history, and let's face it, the woman lived well into her 90s and had lived a lot of the history here and knew everyone. I believe she was adored by everyone. And I feel very blessed that we became very close friends. In fact, she used to call me not only her adopted son, but toward the end after a stroke, she used to call me the elbow because she said she preferred it to a cane, you know, the very proud woman. But she did teach me so much about the local history and the personalities, and she had an incredible archive and library in her own home. And I spent many, many, many hours there at her knee, so to speak, learning from her. And she encouraged me to write this first book that I did since I've been here, Hendersonville and Flat Rock, An Intimate Tour. She wrote the foreword for that book, in fact. And I'm sure that things that I've learned from her are carrying me forward.
Let's go ahead then and dive into some of our local history and artistry. And start us off talking about Jesse E. Osteen, if you will.
Well, first of all, we don't know what E stood for. He didn't have a middle name, so he just chose the letter E, according to his descendants. I would not have known about this man if it weren't for my journeys along the Crab Creek Road. Usually I take it to get to Brevard and beyond. And traveling along that road, I'd noticed almost a Norman Rockwellian scene on the north side of the road, a white farmhouse and rolling green land, some of it obviously pastures in the past, and framed by a mountain range in the background. Just a beautiful setting. Then it broke my heart a little over a year ago when I saw that home being dismantled. And I decided somehow that I was going to photo document the razing of that building. And one time when I was doing that across the street, a lady came out of a subdivision, which used to be part of the farm of the house that I've described. She's a part-time resident and lives in Florida the rest of the year, but she came out of her house and she asked me what I was doing, and I told her, and she smiled and she said, "You wouldn't believe how many people come to this point and photograph that scene and have been doing so for years. In fact, one day a woman set up an easel and did a painting of it." Although the scene was beautiful, I wanted to know everything that made it tick. And I started making inquiries, and I heard everything. You know, there are marvelous storytellers here, but I want the truth. And I finally pinned it down to Reverend Jesse E. Osteen and his wife, Emma Mae Corn Osteen. And Preacher Jess, as they called him, was born in 1888, and he passed away in 1978. He was a Baptist preacher, and he was involved with every Baptist church in Henderson County, some in Polk and some in Transylvania. He founded the Flat Rock Baptist Church in 1960, which was actually built in 61 to 65. I learned more about him than just his ministry. He was a farmer, and he had a molasses mill and molasses still on his property, and a lot of the neighboring farmers would bring their sorghum there to be milled and then to be boiled. And I have photographs from his family of him and his wife making the molasses on the property and having their old workhorse go around and around and around that mill to crush the canes to produce the juice that would become the molasses. I have pictures of Jesse Osteen baptizing people down in the Green River. After studying him and speaking with his nephew and his granddaughters and others, I feel like I know the man, and I like him a lot. And I felt that since it was so difficult to essentially dig him up, please excuse the expression, but I decided he needed some ink. He needed some publicity, and so I included him in this book, Hidden History, Henderson County.
What about the Pleasant Hill Baptist Church?
Well, Pleasant Hill Baptist Church isn't far from where I live, and again, I'm curious about it. And I started digging on it and found out that originally it was the Antioch Baptist Church, organized in 1869, but on a different site. The sanctuary today is brick, and it's quite simple. Beautiful setting up on a berm up above the road where Crab Creek becomes Canuga Road, right at the junction of Little River Road. It was burned in 71 by a suspected arson. And I've written about that man and his hidden history as well. And then rebuilt of brick a year later. I found very little about this church. Maybe the records had burned. I called the Carolina Baptist Association, and they had very little on it. There was no phone number for the church, but I saw on the marquee there that the preacher was Reverend Jonathan Rackley. And I tried to reach him and couldn't find a number for him either. So I stopped in one Sunday and caught him before the church services, and he explained to me something that I thought was rather poignant. He said, you know, history is now as well, and history continues into the future. He said, if you want to learn about this church, you come to services here. And so I did, and I was very blessed, because after the first time I went to church there, I walked out, and Reverend Rackley stopped me, and he said, this lady has something to show you. And one of his congregants had in her Bible a number of Xeroxed copies of the earlier history of the church, from newspaper articles and pages copied out of family Bibles, and it was enough to knit together the earlier history of this church. And then I also found a court case involving this church in 1957 where the congregation had to have a preacher thrown out of the church. And, and I have all of that in the book. I'm not going to take up all the time by telling all of these interesting stories, but it is in the book, Hidden History, Henderson County.
What about this preacher, Reverend Sherman T. Patterson, in the Faith Tabernacle? Can you give us a little bit on that?
Reverend Patterson, like Preacher Jesse Osteen, was a remarkable man. Reverend Patterson did write a little autobiography, which is published as a little monograph, and only so many people have it. And I decided that he needed some ink as well. And so he and his wife are included in this book. A lot of people have heard of the Faith Tabernacle, which was a charming sanctuary located up near where the Unitarian Church is today on Canuga Road. So much history in that area. On one corner we have Covenant Presbyterian, just south of it we have, or I'm sorry, north of it we have Unitarian Church. We have a little log veneered cabin that was where a lady by the name of Lucille Galloway taught Bible classes. She was a member of the Salvation Army, as were Reverend Patterson and his wife. Reverend Patterson was essentially killed in an accident up in Asheville. When he was a young man, he had fallen away from his faith, and he worked in the Asheville laundry, and he was caught up in a machine in some belts and was strangled to death, according to two doctors that had pronounced him dead. A third doctor had just learned a technique for resuscitation, and he tried it on Patterson and revived him. While recovering in the hospital, Reverend Patterson, at the time not a reverend, of course, had a vision, and it was a log structure, and it was the mountains, and it was a congregation, a flock of people, and he secured permission from his siblings who owned that land in that area. In fact, that's where his father had built their home, his childhood home, and built that church with the help of neighbors, and it stood for many, many years. I wish that it had been preserved and was still there, because I think that these places are repositories of history and faith, and I think they deserve to go on more than just in words and pictures, but we do have it documented in Hidden History of Henderson County.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, we have with us Terry Ruskin, a historian, and we're focusing today not on theology but on history and aesthetics tied to the church. But the word church can mean more than... It literally means called out ones. The ekklesia is the Greek word. It can mean more than just Christians. We have the long history of the Old Testament, the Jewish followers. And so, Terry, can you say something about Rabbi Charles Mantenben in the synagogue?
Another remarkable man, and I discovered him quite by chance. I was asked to give a history lecture at Agudas Israel, and when I went to the synagogue to meet with the man who had asked me, lo and behold, he was a professor at my alma mater in Michigan. Small world. We both ended up here in Hendersonville. While meeting with Dr. Frisch in the archives of Agudas Israel, I noticed a poster on the wall, and it was for a summer rabbi by the name of Mantenben, and he was a summer rabbi here in the 1950s. And I asked Dr. Frisch about him, and he started extolling the virtues of this man. And so I continued my studies, discovered that Charles Mantenben did a lot of work in the Southeast. He was born in New York, but he ended up spending most of his life in the Southeast. He was kicked out of Hattiesburg, where he was rabbi, because his flock were threatened by white supremacist groups, because Charles Mantenben fought for the cause of African-American people. And he told his congregation, we as Jews should understand the plight of the blacks in this country. Nevertheless, there were groups that threatened even members of his congregation, and his congregation asked him to leave, and he did. And he spent a great deal of time serving as a summer rabbi in various places, and he ended up in Longview, Texas. But he did spend time here, and he did make his mark on Henderson County, and I interviewed people who were just children when they would attend the synagogue here in Hendersonville, but they well remember Mantenben. I spoke with his 95-year-old daughter in Shreveport over the phone a number of times, and the woman told me that her father used to write her mother a love letter every day and had it at her breakfast place setting in the morning. A very compassionate man. And again, you study these people deeply, and you almost feel as though you know them. I felt that he, too, deserved a couple of pages in this hidden history book. I also wrote of Agudas Israel and its formation and where it is today.
To the listeners, you may want to, as you're getting some samplings here of the hidden history of Henderson County, consider getting a copy of this book yourself. Terry Ruskin, the author, is with us in the air now. Terry, where would they find that book?
After less than 4 months, it sold out, but the publisher is in a second printing of it now. I was at the Genealogical Historical Society yesterday, and I saw they had one copy left. Jane Asher's on Main Street and 4th has a few copies left. The Heritage Museum in the old courthouse has a few copies, and I believe the Joy of Books on Main near 3rd has them. Fountainhead has run out. Perhaps they can find them on Amazon.com. Maybe they'll find them back ordered, but they will be republished soon.
If you're not here local to Henderson County, you may say, well, this doesn't relate much to me, but really it does. Whether we're looking at the missions in the West Coast or samples of churches in the East, history is what made us who we are today. Let's look at another from your book, the Reverend D. Lewis Staton with the Maranatha Baptist Church.
Reverend Staton is still with us, thank God. He was born in 1936, and I wouldn't have discovered him except that I was exploring that entire Crab Creek route, and I was asking about Staton Road, named for this man, because he worked essentially for 10 years to get that road through, to make a safe access to and from DuPont for the employees there. Reverend Staton was an employee with DuPont for many years, and I was actually granted an interview with the man, who is very humble and quite remarkable. And like a lot of these other people that I've written about, he doesn't really blow his own horn. I love humility. I think it's a beautiful thing. And having come from a marketing background, I look at it as one of my responsibilities to trumpet the praises of others who don't speak of themselves. Reverend Staton and his wife have done missionary work in Russia. They have books published in Russian. He's just a remarkable man, and I feel so blessed to know him.
What about the story of the repurposed windows of the 1905 sanctuary of Hendersonville's First Presbyterian Church?
For anyone who hasn't been at Covenant Presbyterian Church on Canoga Road, you need to go in and look at those windows from the inside during the daytime when the light floods through them. They are absolutely magnificent. They're huge. My interest in history includes my appreciation for repurposing and restoring versus renovating. And I see the story of these windows as remarkable. They were two of the windows that furnished the First Presbyterian Church of Hendersonville. There have been three churches there, and the second one was built in 1905, and it included those windows, which when that building was dismantled, before the new one was constructed, the old windows were stored in a what's been described as a corn crib or some kind of an outbuilding on a farm. And when the members were forming Covenant, it had come to their attention that those windows existed. And they found them, but they were in quite a state of disrepair. And so they took pieces from one that was almost unsalvageable and used the pieces of this very rare glass, colors they don't even make anymore, textures that are very difficult to replicate. And they restored those windows, and they essentially the Covenant was designed around those windows. I delved a little bit into the history of each of the churches as well. Certainly not as much as I would have liked to, but publishers do put a limit on your words and images that you can use in books. But the story of those windows is in hidden history.
Excellent. Terry, we have just about 5 or 6 minutes left. And let's give focus finally to the Canoga Conference Center, the Chapel of the Transfiguration, and related history in Canoga.
Many people know about Canoga conferences. It has wonderful hiking trails, and it has, of course, conference facilities. A division of the Forestry Service has practice fires there. There are scout troops and others who enjoy the wonders of nature and the many classes that are held and programs that are held at Canoga conferences. But, of course, it started way back in 1909 when George Stevens, a banker from Charlotte, decided to purchase the land and develop it as a retreat, beginning with his fellow students from Chapel Hill. And it was going to be a very exclusive resort, timeshare sort of a thing. And his vision was growing, and he was a very... in fact, George Stevens's banking enterprises today are known as Bank of America. That's how huge this man was. But the 1916 flood essentially washed away his vision, and he put the land up for sale at a greatly reduced cost. And at the time, Bishop Finley was looking for land for a retreat center. That he had nowhere near the money to purchase the land, but he worked very passionately, very zealously with other Episcopal dioceses in the Western Carolinas, And he even got George Stevens to kick in a big amount of money. That's how persuasive this man was. He traveled to New York. He traveled everywhere else, fundraising. That's how Canuga Conferences came to be, an Episcopal retreat center that's known internationally. The Chapel of Transfiguration was built with timber from the site. Much of it had come down during a horrendous ice storm, and it was saved for the purpose of possibly repurposing the lumber. Richard Sharp Smith, the famous architect who designed our classic courthouse in Henderson County, the one that now houses the Heritage Museum, and also designed up at Biltmore. He designed all the cottages and the original pavilion and conference center at Canuga. And the architect who resurrected the Calvary Church in Fletcher was pulled in to design the Chapel of the Transfiguration, and it too is an architectural marvel and definitely worthy of a visit. If anyone hasn't been in it, you really need to go in and look at all that beautiful knotty pine and the beautiful stained glass windows and enjoy another one of Henderson County's architectural treasures.
Listeners, again, this is Terry Ruskin with us. We're talking about history as it relates to the church. And Terry, in closing, if we've got some listeners who say history, what's that matter? What would you say to them?
Well, it matters a great deal. As they say, if we don't know where we came from, how do we know where we're going? I think that it's a marvelous thing when people take pride in their heritage and their history. Look at how popular genealogy is today, all the websites like Ancestry.com and whatnot. Of course, I love it myself, and I enjoy it. It's a wonderful avocation that tends to keep your mind off things that aren't so pleasant as well.
I find this amazing to see, really, relatively speaking, you know, as we get older in life, how young our country really is, this nation of America. We go back, as we've done in our program here, to the missions, and we're in the 1700s, and it's not that long ago.
No, it's not, especially when you have tromped all over Europe and you see places that are 700, 800, 900 years old and still preserved, which is wonderful. I think that America is finally getting it, and we're starting to preserve our historic monuments. I just wish there was a lot more of it.
Well, and I want to express appreciation for what you're doing here where you live in Henderson County, which, listeners, if you're not local, this is just south of Asheville in the mountains of West North Carolina. But you have taken time to go back and research the details of stories, and you found edifices that are about to be taken down. You've taken pictures, and you've done your best to preserve the history. I just want to thank you for this, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thank you for being with us, and we'll see you next week.
This has been Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening, and if you'd like to help support this ministry, or if you'd like to know more about Beyond Words, visit us on our website at scriptureawakening.com.